There are many values for coming on retreat, practicing meditation, being on the Buddhist path. And one of them is to hear properly. Is that loud enough? Little louder? So let's see, is that louder now? That's good now? Okay, so what? Little bit more? Number two. Let's see now. So, how are we doing now? Getting there now? So, we've accomplished one of the purposes of. So, but one of the purposes is to be able to shift our perspectives. And there's many perspectives we can use in our lives. And many people never reflect on their perspective they use, and they just use whatever perspective they happen to grow up with or have or handed, or it can be almost really unconscious that we even have a perspective. We assume that we see reality as it really is, but it's the perspective through which we see can be really thick. And part of the beauty or the wonderfulness about this practice is that as it kind of it's a kind of a deconstruction process. It's a process of taking off all those wedding gowns or all those skins, taking off a lot of the concepts and ideas that we live through, and taking them off, getting simpler and simpler, and then getting a new perspective. One perspective is the perspective that is able to see these concepts, ideas, biases, prejudices, projections that when they return and see them for what they are, rather than assume that it's built into the nature of the universe that it's a particular way. Another value of it is to become flexible in shifting between perspectives. And there isn't like one state or one way of being, one perspective that's the right one. But rather, in different contexts, we have different perspectives and we can move between them as is appropriate. And sometimes we get trapped in certain certain perspectives. And so maybe you can imagine that there could be someone who's been on retreat for a week and they have left their dutifully put their smartphone in the manager's office the cabinet, and they retrieve it, and they're pretty good. They don't check it while they're still here, and they drive out down to the just north on Highway 1. It's beautiful, where there's beautiful beaches and expansive views of the Pacific, and so then now we can take out the phone. And it doesn't quite work. And it's important to get those messages. It's important to be able to call someone. But there's something wrong. The button doesn't work. It seems to have electricity, but why doesn't it work properly? It's kind of on, but kind of not working. And the world, the perspective on the world, zeroes in. And the only thing that exists is the phone and the problems and the dire consequences and the end of the world. And it didn't, and for some reason the person then gets in the car, dashes off to the closest smart store's phone and irate because of their phone, and they missed an opportunity. They were at one of the most astounding coastlines in the country. The beaches and the ocean and the blue and the sky and the whales out there. There's this huge different perspective. Perspective about what is our place in this universe? Who are we? Why are we here? What does it matter if a phone works or doesn't work when you have the Pacific looking out across? When I was 20, I hitchhiked around the country, and my favorite place to hitchhike was from Santa Cruz to San Francisco on Highway 1. And sometimes I was disappointed if I got a ride too quickly. Because I would just stand there and just look at the ocean, look at the road, look at the hills, and have my thumb out and sing Janis Joplin about freedom. It's just another word for nothing left to lose, for those of you who are old enough. And anyway, so there it is. You know, this huge perspective and wonderful. And then we have a whole different perspective on our life and what's important, and cell phones no longer matter. And for moments, for a few crazy minutes, you say, I don't care if I ever get a cell phone ever again. Because it's just like, wow, this freedom. A free mind. You've been sitting so long and the mind is open and relaxed, and like going to the beach. Poof, the cosmic place in our, it's just awe-inspiring. When I went down the Grand Canyon a couple of years ago, and I touched at the very bottom, at the deepest level you can get to in Grand Canyon, you can see and you can touch a rock that was formed 1 billion years ago. Now that's a long time, and that's pretty amazing just to do just that. But what's more amazing is those rocks in the Grand Canyon formed 1 billion years ago, layers and layers down. They were formed south of the equator. Now, what are they doing up there? Because there wasn't any wall they could get in. So we have this tight, you know, these continental plates that are moving, right? And they slowly move. 1 billion years is a lot of years, you know, centimeter a year or something. And so eventually, billion years, it makes it up here. So the scale that we live under. So there's a story, a Buddhist story, that's a grander scale, vast scale of this cosmos, where 1 billion years is just the blink of an eye. If you take a solid granite block, marble block, that's 1 mile by 1 mile by 1 mile, a cube. And every 100 years, a little bird with the softest little feathers brushes against the granite, the marble. The amount of time it takes for that 1 mile cube to wear down is how long you go back to the beginning of Buddhism. That Buddhism, once upon a time, that far ago, that long ago, there was a man named the Maker of Light, Dipankara. And Dipankara was a hermit, kind of a renunciant, living in the mountains, in the woods, doing ascetic practices. And one day he overheard people say the word Buddha. And he said, Buddha, what's that? Is a Buddha? And sure enough, the Buddha of that era, that long ago, countless eons ago, had come to his area of his near him. So he was very excited. He really wanted to see the Buddha. And so he went down to town where they're expecting the Buddha, and a lot of people were out, and you know, to receive. It was a big celebrity of the times, I guess. And then he saw the Buddha in the distance, and he was so moved by this Buddha. He decided, you know, he didn't have anything to offer. Other people offering flowers and putting flower petals on the ground, and he had nothing to offer. But as an ascetic, he had long hair, and there was mud on where the Buddha was going to walk. So he lay down on the ground and flipped his hair out so it landed in the puddle. So when the Buddha walked on the, you know, there, he wouldn't get dirty. And as he was laying there thinking about the Buddha, he had a thought. He had an aspiration. He thought, I would like to become a Buddha. I would like to someday be able to help as many people in this world as a Buddha can help people. And that Buddha that time came and saw the guy there. I think he walked across his hair, because that's what you do. And then the Buddha stopped and recognized that this man had something. And then he predicted him, and he said, incalculable eons from now. And in one eon, there's many universes that expand. The Buddhism believes in the yo-yo theory of the universe. The universe expands and contracts and gets, and it's been doing that for, you know, many, many, many times. And these three incalculable kalpas, you know, it goes back. Just one kalpa is that square block, right? But many more of them. That far in the future, Dipankara will become a Buddha named Gautama Buddha. So then he said, well, what do I do to become a Buddha? Well, he had to prepare himself. He had to cultivate the qualities needed to become a Buddha. So he spent incalculable lifetimes preparing to be born in our world, in our eon, our kind of situation, just a blink of an eye ago, to be a Buddha for our time. And what he did for all those lifetimes is he practiced the paramis. Practicing the paramis is how he prepared himself to become a Buddha. How he prepared himself to be someone who was wise, someone who knew the depths of possibility of letting go, to be really become free of all the shackles and all the constrictions, all the weight that we can carry with us, all the suffering. And he could have the requisite compassion that was needed, the maha karuna needed for it to be a Buddha. So that scale, that perspective, are you going to go back to your little cell phone and its problems that are found through that screen? How could they have written that? Uh-oh. Oh, no. Oh, yes. that's a little world you can enter into. Or what about, is there a vaster perspective, a vaster life that you can live in? Is there a perspective that changes your relationship to what's in that little screen? As perspective of life's abundance, life's magnitude, life's the strength, a perspective that where, you know, you look up at the stars at night, some places in the world where there's very little urban light and you can see so many stars. And you might feel like you're just stardust, just like insignificant little thing. But it's glorious to be insignificant then. It's wow. It just goes on and on and on and on. And what a universe we live in. And maybe this is our home. Maybe this is a place where we belong. Maybe this is a place we can be free. Maybe we can just kind of not get caught up in the little dramas and buttons and miswirings in that cell phone in our head. Pretty soon your cell phone's gonna be smarter than you with all those processors. So it's kind of, we know it's a perspective. It's open up wide. Don't get caught in these little details of self, me, myself, and mine, and what's all this, what's in it for me. And the beauty of this, to open up and be free, is that we have inside of us, and we've had it probably inside of us for innumerable kalpas, all the way back to the time of Dipankara, because according to this myth, this folklore, we've been doing the same trip the Buddha did over and over again, lifetime after lifetime. But he discovered what he had inside. He discovered he had the paramis, and he developed them and grew them. You have the paramis in you. If they've been awakened already in some degree, great. Maybe this is the first time you've heard about them. They are maybe living inside of you as potentials for a whole different perspective, a whole different way of living, a whole different even purpose of how to live. To have a purpose of living a life of generosity. To have a purpose of life to be have ethical integrity. To have a real purpose, glorious purpose. If you want to use hyperbole, glorious renunciation. To let go of all those constrictions and the narrowness and the small, tight, little, self-preoccupied perspectives. Let go, and it's like, wow, it's the Pacific Ocean again. We have inside of us the potential for wisdom. To be wise people. Every single one of us has that potential. We have the potential of making enlivening, nourishing effort and energy. We have capacity for all the different forms of patience, endurance, perseverance, forgiveness. We have the capacity for truth, finding the truth, knowing the truth, being truthful. What a purpose that would be. We have the potential and as a purpose of life to have a resolve on truth. A glorious purpose is to live a life of loving kindness, of friendliness, where we keep all people in our heart. We commit ourselves, we have the resolve to do our best to leave no one out of our hearts. And then the capacity for equanimity. Not an indifference, but the equanimity which is the pinnacle of all this. The equanimity that kind of like the cream on the cake of all nine paramis. The equanimity that purifies everything else. So there's no reactivity, no self, no neurotic preferences. We're just kind of there with this balanced, open perspective to whatever. So all the paramis can be. This can be a purpose of life. And then if we add to that mix, that we also can become something like a Buddha. We also can experience a degree of liberation might be, several degrees less than the Buddha himself, but enough then to liberation that our freedom becomes a gift to the world. The minimum gift it is that if you're really free spiritually, it's harder and harder to harm anybody else. And so, your freedom makes you a person who's safe for the world. And what a beautiful thing to do, to be someone who's safe for others. And your practice can be what really awakens a tremendous capacity for compassion. The world needs more compassionate people. And these paramis are social virtues. They really come into play as we go into our life and live our lives with other people. And this path of practice that we do has very little, at some point it's not really possible to do this practice that we do here if you're only doing it for yourself. It's fine to do it for yourself when that's what the call is. It's completely appropriate. But at some point, some glorious point, you'll realize you can no longer keep doing it if you're only doing it for yourself. You still do it for yourself, but also for all beings. And that's when you become Buddha-like. And I hope that that happens sooner than how long it takes to wear down a 1 mile cube of marble. May it happen in this lifetime. May the paramis and liberation and compassion and all the perspective that brings help you to live a sane, wise, caring life where you care for yourself and the world around you. So thank you. So, now it's your turn. If you would like to ask a few questions, we have a little bit of time, and partly what we're doing here is beginning the transition so that you're kind of ready to leave tomorrow, and doing something in the hall that's different and this evening and a little more energetic is part of that transition making that we're doing and sharing. And so asking questions is part of that. So if you haven't had a chance to ask questions in the hall so far, and there might be one or two questions that are been sitting around. Maybe you can know, maybe since, we'll go down the row. So that, why don't we start with Bruni? You can ask a question for Bruni, then Gulu, and then I'll come to me.
I have noticed sometimes that it seems like my mind becomes more rebellious immediately after a retreat. And I'm wondering, is that an accurate impression? And second, what's a skillful way to work with that using the paramis?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Use any of the paramis that call in your heart. Renounce. Check in what is important. It's normal to, you know, coming out of retreat, it takes some time to adjust. So all kinds of minds may show up. Patience. You will know. Does that?
This is really the first time I've done a Vipassana retreat. Before this, I used to meditate for a few years, and then I left meditation. My recent practice had been a sitting meditation. Like, I left sitting meditation. My recent practice had been sitting meditation for about half an hour to an hour every Friday with a group. So I guess my question is, this retreat has been wonderful, and I've had a lot of amazing insights. But when I get back, again, my question is, if I can't do a sitting meditation every day, just watching myself while I'm going through my day, sometimes I have the best meditation when I'm washing dishes. Is that enough?
It's certainly a beautiful cultivation to have. Is this loud enough?
Yeah.
You hear me? Okay. To have more and more awareness as we go through our daily life. And I think, you know, that's part of what we're training here, is to bring the quality of awareness that we can have sitting here quietly into whatever we're doing in our daily life. I don't know how to answer the question enough, because enough is a kind of an evaluation or a score. Or...
Yeah, that's actually not what I meant. Can I see that as part of a practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you hear me? Not having spoken, I think I've lost my voice the last week. My question has to do with how the paramis are. I noticed that para mí is in Spanish, it's for me. It's similar. But I want to know how they sometimes work in practice. For example, with regard to wisdom, you spoke about how an act is wise when it benefits yourself and others and everybody. And that's a sound principle. But in practice, there are times, for example, I can give you two examples, when you do something that's good for one person, but it's actually hurtful to somebody else. And sometimes that's just unavoidable. And how does that come into, how do the paramis come into play in that situation? Another situation I can think of, for example, is with regard to alcoholics. It's difficult to distinguish between times when you're helping somebody and you're making them codependent, that it's helping them in a way that's actually harmful. So, you know, I understand what you say when you mean wisdom, but how do you then take that to the next step and make the difficult decisions related to that?
It's a great question. I really appreciate that. You can only keep that. It's a great question. I appreciate that you would ask it, and it shows care and attention and taking this life seriously. And I think it's building on that is how you find the answer. Inquiry, asking those questions and being interested, where is the greatest good? Where is it that, is there some, let's not settle too quickly that it's one or the other. Maybe there's a way, maybe there's a third option that we haven't thought about yet. Let me think about it and think about, is there an option that benefits everyone? Or is the best I can do is to reduce harm the most I can? Maybe there has to be, maybe there will be harm done. If I drive my car, Bay Area, I'm harming someone. So I try to reduce that harm. I try to drive as little as I can. And do I not drive at all? Some people say then it's a balance between where's the greatest good, or, you know, where's, you know, how does the scales weigh between harm and benefit? And so it's a difficult question. There's no, I don't know of any clear, clean answer to these questions, except that The best and most inspiring answer is to keep inquiry, keep the investigation going, keep it close to your heart, this concern, and be creative in thinking about alternatives. So that really benefits people. No one's left out.
Thank you.
Great. So we should go on for our little evening. In a few minutes, Lish will make some announcements about the closing and what you need to know for the end. And I want to take this opportunity to make explicit what is often implicit here. It's kind of important that it's kind of how implicit or not emphasized too much, but at the end of the retreat, it's a good time to mention it, is that part of what is kind of like the medium is the message. And so the medium of what happens here at IRC is part of the message of IRC. Or to say it differently, the medium is the nourishment. And so how we're set up, what this community is like, is intentionally done to try to create the best conditions for the heart to grow and to expand and become, you know, and do the practice. And so, for example, one of the primary fuels for this center and this community that's here, you know, that's supporting this, is generosity. There is a whole, you know, big circles and circles of people for over 10 years who've been supporting this place with their work and their donations and all kinds of things to make this possible. And, you know, I'm kind of blown away still when I come down here, this place exists. When we wanted, you know, I kind of wanted a retreat center at some point, thought it'd be a good thing to do. And I thought we would get a moldy cabins in a Boy Scout camp deep in ex-Boy Scout camp deep in the woods. And we got this. And we got this because of people's generosity. And when I look around, everything in this room, I know someone, a volunteer, has considered, researched, thought about, tried to see how this would best work for a retreat center, for people who are on retreat. And you know, for someone to volunteer their time and to really think about it, they had a lot of love. And so there's a lot, I see love when I see this building. Even like the color, I didn't know there were so many different colors of white to choose from. You know, it's just astounding. So we come into this place of generosity, and with that, a tremendous amount of goodness. You know, to have people who want to support us and do everything we do here, it's a lot. It's their goodness. It's their good hearts. They have a lot of paramis. And so we're kind of riding this and supported by it and informed by it. And it's kind of the medium as a message, in that the message of Buddhism is freedom and liberation that's expressed through gratitude and goodness and generosity and the paramis and all kinds of things. It's easy to take. It's kind of a funny thing having a place like this. I kind of want people to take it for granted. And I kind of want them to be nourished and know how special it is. So when I first came to Buddhism, I kind of realized this once we had done all this work to create this. When I came to Buddhism, I was 20 or something, and I went to the San Francisco Zen Center. And when I got there, the building was less than 10 years old. I mean, in terms of Zen Center owning it. And so we've owned this building for now 10 years. So they've owned that, I think, for less than 10 years by the time I got there. I was 20, and I just took it for granted. Like, it's always been here. You know, it's just, this is how it is, and you know, it's just there, and we could use it and, you know, be there. And I just like, oh, you know, just like mom and dad are just there, and, you know, just take it from granted, you know. And then created this place, I realized, wait a minute, there was a lot of people back at Zen Center in the 1960s. They put a lot of work into making it happen. But no one ever told me about them. I never thought about it. And I was so glad, because it's nice to take it for granted. And just not to have that somehow, just kind of allowed me to relax somehow. But it's also nice to be nourished by all the goodness that's here, the goodwill that's here. And I hope that to some degree you felt it here, and my reminding you about this amazing thing we have that works so well, and works so well because of goodness and goodwill, gratitude, generosity. It's just like, you know, it's a kind of a bright light. So nourish yourself from it. Let it support you.
Since I have this, can I make one suggestion? Is this on? Well, with regard to, first of all, I want to thank you for this place. I mean, you're right. When I heard about this, I thought I was coming to some moldy Boy Scout camp, and I was okay with it. I would have come anyway, but I think that everybody who comes here wants to support it however we can. But it's hard to have it'd be good to have a sense of scale. I don't know whether you could provide that information. In other words, I don't know whether $50 a day, $100, $1,000, what makes a difference?
It's a lot of things possible. You know, we're trying to create Buddhism for all these eons to come. So if you want to give everything you have, we'll just keep doing it and doing it, you know. If you're inspired and stay tomorrow afternoon or a little bit after closing, and help clean the dishes when everyone else is gone, that will also be the fantastic gift that will support eons of people. So it all depends on what scale you're going to do it at. Thank you.